Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Despite being one of baseball's all-time true superstars, Ty Cobb is today as much remembered for being called a racist than as for his amazing sports prowess. He won 12 batting titles, including 9 in a row. He batted 400 three times, won the American League slugging title 9 times. And despite, you would think he was this behemoth, he had the moxie rather than speed. He wasn't the fastest runner. To have stolen the third most bases in baseball history. His lifetime batting average, .366, the highest of all time to this day. Compare that, for example, with San Francisco Giant greats Willie Mays, .302, a long way from .366, and Barry Bonds, .298, an even longer way from .366. And as I said, all that, despite not being a super physical specimen, and I don't think they had performance-enhancing drugs back then. Ty Cobb insisted that the key to his success was his degree of study of opposing players and his overall great desire to succeed. Relatedly, Cobb was also one of the more intelligent pro athletes I've certainly ever heard of. He's known, for example, to have loved biographies of Thomas Jefferson and Napoleon, and his favorite novel, Victor Hugo's pro-proletariat classic, Les Miserables. Cobb's reputation, not only as a racist, but was as of someone who succeeded because he played dirty and he was an overall bad guy. Now, most of us, probably none of us who are listening to this show, certainly me, will ever be a pro athlete. But in our work and our personal lives, our reputation is key. Key to our success, as Virgin's Richard Branson said, all you have in business is your reputation. Plus, our reputation affects how we feel about ourselves and the life we're living. To help us learn lessons about what to do and not to do to manage our reputation, using that vivid example of Ty Cobb, is Charles Leeson. He is the author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, which was a New York Times bestseller that won the Casey Award for Baseball Book of the Year. And the final words of the New York Times' review of that book are that the book, quote, gives us a human being rather than a myth served up whole, end quote. The Boston Globe called it, quote, assiduously researched and his points lucidly expressed, end quote. Charles has written for the New York Times Magazine, for Rolling Stone, and he was an editor at Sports Illustrated. Charles Leeson, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. Happy to be here with you.
Good. Well, how did Ty Cobb acquire the reputation as a racist?
Well, it's funny. He's had a singular journey through the media, Ty Cobb. We should say, you know, he played a long time ago. He played from 1905 to 1928, so he retired before the Great Depression even, and he died in 1961. And it was only after his death that he started to acquire the reputation as a monstrous human being, interestingly enough. And the way this happened, it was in his case, he had one sports writer who wrote a scurrilous and scandalous and completely unfact-checked article about him. That caused a lot of controversy after his death, depicting him as a drunken, you know, a waver of guns and the misogynist and everything else. People became fascinated by this story. It became a big subject of the day, and people talked about it. It was much discussed in newspapers. Of course, there were a lot more newspapers back in 1961, newspaper columnists, and on the radio and on television. People talked about this. And no one had heard any bad stories about famous baseball players before. This was 9 years before the book, Jim Boughton's book, Ball Four, for example, which was often cited, is often cited as the first book that sort of ripped the lid off baseball and showed you that these guys were hardly, you know, saints. So here was this guy named Al Stump, this hack sports writer who wrote this story. People latched onto it. They started to repeat it, and they started to talk about it, and they started to embroider on it and add things. The germ of truth, you might say, that was in this was that Ty Cobb in his day was a very fierce, competitive, cranky man, hard to get along with. But he played the game fiercely, didn't suffer fools gladly, and he had that kind of a reputation as a guy that was temperamental and hard to get along with. And so this sort of built on that and made it believable. And over the years, other writers have written other articles and books and embroidered on this further, and people seem to love this myth of Ty Cobb. They assume, because he was born in northern Georgia, in the hills of Georgia, in 1886, that he was a racist. How could you not be a racist? So that became part of the myth without really any evidence, and so that's how the story snowballed from this one article, believe it or not, that was written in 1961.
Amazing. And, you know, in reading your book, you described him as actually a progressive on race for his time and during his age. To go from that to one journalist writing this, and then the meme keeps spreading and spreading, and we all like to spread dirt, unfortunately. And it's wasn't there some legitimacy to the, I mean, was it really just one hack journalist?
Well, you know, believe it or not, it's a case of a snowball that started rolling, and other people joined in, and as I say, added things and embroidered on it and repeated the story and told it over and over. I guess one lesson here is you cannot judge people based on where they grew up and even when they grew up. You say, well, how could a white man born in 1886 in rural Georgia, how could he not be racist? And it's easy to make that assumption, but what I found when going back to the original sources and the census reports and the letters and the family trees was that Ty Cobb descended from a long line of abolitionists, that his great-grandfather was a preacher who preached against slavery and got run out of town for it. His grandfather refused to fight with the Confederate Army over the slavery issue, and that his father was a state senator and an educator who spoke up for his black constituents and had a very short political career as a result in Georgia, and who once broke up a lynch mob in town. So that's the background that this one individual descended from. And the business about the racism is it's all comes without any proof or evidence or examples of anything, it's hard to shake. You know, one reason when people love to spread dirt about people, they love especially a story that makes them feel good about themselves, that makes them feel superior. So when people tell this story, they love to say, you know, the part of the joy of it is to say, well, I'm not a racist too. I'm better than this. I don't believe in this. So that they love a story like that where they can feel superior, and especially to a famous person, I think, and it makes them feel better about themselves.
How much of the fact that this reputation has existed is that he didn't have a countervailing force to defend him? Like Martin Luther King was called by a number of journalists a plagiarizer, a womanizer, and a communist, but his family has continued to fight vigorously against such claims, and now he's one of our most revered figures. I mean, they have a national holiday in his honor. How much of the problem was that Ty Cobb has not had a vigorous countervailing force?
Well, I think you've hit on something there, Marty. I think that's a big part of it. He was not around to defend himself. himself, because, like I say, these things started after his death in 1961. So that was a big factor. He was out of baseball. Once he retired as a player, he didn't stay in baseball, so he didn't have those connections. All he had was his grandchildren, really, who didn't really have access to the media, were shocked by what they were hearing. It didn't match up with their stories of their grandfather that they knew. And they would, you know, tell whoever they could tell, but they didn't have access to the media. So it was not just a neutral story that was out there. Like I say, it was a story that people liked. It was a lurid story, and and people felt superior to it. You know, there's the movie The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance has a famous line in it: "When the legend beats the fact, print the legend." And that's what happened to Ty Cobb. You know, the legend was seen to be better than the facts, and so people went with the fake story.
Okay, now you've done a good job of painting the story and how the reputation came into existence. Now I want to apply it to us. We all have reputations we need to manage, and there are always going to be some people who will be our detractors who, subtly or not so subtly, will try to affect it. And I'm going to ask you, we'll have a conversation about what we might do. We'll talk about, actually, if you were Ty Cobb's administrator, what would you do to resurrect his reputation, if only so that his memorabilia weren't worth zero and simply his reputation is good. But first, I want to let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking about how to manage your reputation with the author of probably the definitive biography of a guy who was probably the baseball player with the biggest gap between his baseball ability and achievements and his overall reputation. That is Ty Cobb. The subtitle of the book is Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. I'm talking with Charles Learson. Okay, so imagine, I know you're not a reputation manager, you're a biographer, but if you were today, as you say, if anything, his reputation as a racist is accelerated, because in our era where so much is viewed by race, class, and gender, what if you were his estate administrator right now, or even PR person, what would you, Charles Learson, do to try to restore fairness to his reputation?
Well, I think it's always important to ask nicely, but ask for evidence. You know, when you see a reputation, you know, this starts, we see it as part of human nature. It happens in the playground when we're little kids, happens in, you know, in grade school. One kid will get a reputation, you know, as the kid who smells bad or something like that. And it'll always be stuck on him, and people will repeat it because they like it, and they like to be not the person who's got that reputation. But if you ask for evidence, in the case of Ty Cobb, people will say he was an avowed racist. I'll hear that a lot. I say, well, when did he make this vow, and where did he make it, and can you show me where this is? In fact, I'll save you the trouble of looking for it. There are no examples of this, and there are examples in contrary. In Ty Cobb's case, he actually attended Negro League games, and he hung out with the players, and he's got quotes supporting the integration of baseball. So if you ask people to supply the evidence sometimes, or ask other people to step in for you, surrogates, and ask for evidence when you're condemning someone or saying negative things about it, often that's where you find the gap between what people wish was true and what really is true, and what they can prove is true, because they often can't produce the evidence.
I'm actually surprised that there is no evidence at all that he said something racist or whatever, because usually when people develop a bad reputation, it's not because there isn't a grain of truth in it, it's that it gets amplified and promulgated by a person's detractors. So my guess, and this is like standard PR 101, but I'm curious what you think of this, but if I were his administrator or Ty Cobb's administrator or PR person, I would say, yes, I have now identified three things that he has said that indeed were certainly in our modern times be viewed as racist. And I would stipulate to those up front so that both enhanced my credibility and I was not seen as an ideologue. And then I would say, here is the countervailing, to use your point, evidence. And so net-net, do you think justice is served by painting this man so disproportionately as a racist, or would there be a more nuanced view that's more appropriate? What do you think of that approach?
Well, I think it's good when it applies. I think I did something in the same thing. If we go back and think about the way I presented it earlier in our conversation, I said, he was born in Georgia in 1886. How could he not be a racist? That was my way of just rhetorically. I was being sincere about it, but it's my way rhetorically of trying to meet you halfway to say I understand why you feel this way, and mm-hmm. that's sort of similar to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. In Ty Cobb's case, I couldn't find. I wow. researched this for 4 years. I couldn't wow. find examples of
not one example. That's amazing.
Of his saying anything racist, and as I say, I found things to the contrary. I think he was an enlightened man. He descended from a long line of abolitionists. He also just, it wasn't a topic. You know, it's part of maybe the racism of America that there were no black people in baseball when he played baseball. No black men were allowed to play. I mean, and so it that took the whole topic kind of off the table, and it people didn't go around asking each other. You know, in his case with racism, the word racist wasn't really even in the dictionary in 1961 when he died, before the civil rights movement. The closest you could get was the word racialist, which sort of implied like wacky scientific theories about racial inferiority and superiority, but the word racist wasn't even there. People didn't think in those terms. But yes, I agree that you should try to understand why people might think the wrong thing, or if you could find, I guess, an example of places where the person might have sullied his reputation or muddied the water somehow. But in Cobb's case, I couldn't find that, but I could find a very strong reason why people would guess that he felt a certain way.
Before we leave the racist, and, you know, he also had a reputation as both a dirty player and as just an overall hothead and jerk, but I want to always tie it back to the mandate of this show, which is to focus on career issues. So it seems to me that there are what I call buglers, people who, whether in your workplace, who have a particularly wide audience, they may be prone to gossip mongering, they may be powerful or whatever. So it seems very important that you, be very, very aware, this is why they always talk about office politics, that you be very aware of who the credible buglers are and try to ensure at least that you have a neutral reputation, if not a positive one, with that person. And if you're sensing that there is some unfair machinations that the person is doing to destroy you, and in fact many employees try to destroy their bosses to get their job, or simply because they want to, quote, speak truth to power, or they hate hierarchy. So critical would seem to me to find who the buglers are in your workplace, or in a case of a public figure like Ty Cobb, who are the influential people. Obviously, the New York Times has long been the publication of record, including in sports. So finding the key reporters, and I would be presenting a dispositive case to that New York Times reporter who is sports writer, who would hopefully set the record straight. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a good idea, and I think Cobb actually, in his day, his sports athletes and sports writers communicated more. They were on the same socioeconomic level in Ty Cobb's day, and they hung around socially and went to each other's homes and visited each other and things like that. And Cobb did that. I think he did it. It just came naturally. But he also later in life, he was very conscious of the as I say, he wasn't called a racist during his lifetime, but the dirty player accusation was out there, and he did try to approach writers, and he would roll up his pants and show them the scars that he had on his legs from other guys who'd spiked him when he slid into the base, and said, you know, try to say, well, the game was a rougher thing in my day, and I got spiked as much or more as I ever spiked anyone, and so he did address that, and he did try to reach out to the important people. It is a good idea to find those people who are influential in the workplace and also, as you say, prone to gossip and prone to spreading these kind of stories, and try to communicate with them and keep the lines of communication open with them. And very often just the fact that you're communicating with them breaks down the you know, their evil intent, or, you know, it sort of dissipates that, I think.
You know, I did actually read your book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, in part because it's so clearly written. And I was, you know, surprised. I would have thought, because he had this reputation as a hothead, that he would have been cantankerous with the media, and yet you pointed out example after example of how he was, the operative word was gracious. And so it wasn't even enough that he talked with, you know, not only did he speak with the media, not only, you know, about this dirty player thing, not only did he actually show the literal scars, but he apparently was extremely gracious, and yet it still didn't work. He developed that, I would imagine, even during his lifetime, he developed that relationship, that reputation as a dirty player. How did that occur?
Well, in baseball it occurs because it's a business of competition. Of course, every business is. We compete with the people that we work with, and we compete with people in rival companies. So he had people that were, you know, he had a love-hate relationship, Ty Cobb, with the fans in the other cities. They loved him in Detroit, where he was his home team for 26 of his 28 years, but he 20 of his 22 years playing. But in other cities, he was both a huge draw. People would come out to see him, but he was also disliked because he was so good, and he was therefore so potentially dangerous to the home team. So out of town sports writers would prey on this idea, because he was a very aggressive base runner and a very canny base runner. Yeah, we have to put ourselves back in his day. Baseball was not a game of hitting home runs. In his day, it was a game of getting on base and then getting around one base at a time.
Small ball.
The ball was dead. It didn't fly out of the
right.
out of the ballpark.
Right.
So that heightened the actual idea of competition. So there was this like clawing effect where you would kind of claw your way around the bases. And Ty Cobb was a master of that. So people sort of, and also in his day, oddly enough, people were interested in they were fascinated by spikes in a way that they aren't now. They take them for granted now, but there was something new then, and the people watching in the stands didn't play Little League baseball in 1905, and so they had no experience with these spikes. So these myths got started, but Cobb actually had 9 different kinds of slides. Most of them were involved avoiding being tagged. And in 1910, he actually asked the commissioner of the American League, the president of the American League, to ask the players to dull their spikes with a file. And that was kind of a PR move on his part, because he was trying to he knew about this reputation in 1910 that he had already, and he was trying to fight that reputation. He was still trying to fight it when he was an old man and retired, and he wrote a book with a guy just before he died. That guy turned out to be Al Stump, the guy who turned on him. Mm-hmm. But he wrote one of those baseball biographies, those as-told-to kind of books, with a ghostwriter, and to try to set the record straight. The problem was Al Stump made up a lot of stuff, not harmful to Cobb, but made up a lot of sort of crazy B-movie stories and everything. And that book, which is called My Life in Baseball, is largely fiction. And Cobb was ill and old and tried to stop it and was threatening to sue, but died before he could do that. So that book wound up not clearing up his reputation at all. But he was writing a book. He was going around in newspaper guys and talking about it. He was very conscious and wanted to, because he was very proud of the way he did things. He did things, and this may relate to people at the job. If you do things your own way in a different way, and people don't like that, you know, and misunderstand it, you can have a PR problem with that. And he was. That was his problem. He did things in a very unique way, and had to do a lot of explaining to show that he wasn't crazy. He was just sort of trying to pretend to be crazy.
You know, just again bringing this back to our lives today, the media is much more powerful than it ever was. In part because the media has been trained in today's journalism schools to be advocacy journalists rather than being fair and balanced, and so very often they have, in addition to the desire to topple the mighty, there are these political biases. And so tying it back to you, dear listeners, in your workplace, And one other thing is that everybody is a journalist today. You can blog, you can tweet, whatever, and rumors can get spread instantly, so that if somebody searches on your name, you know, one person saying something about you can, if somebody were to call you a racist or a sexist or whatever the hell is, and those are the worst things you can call somebody today, basically, other than a murderer, you're going to pay a huge price. So please, in your own work life, even if you don't see yourself as a famous person, you may not be, but all it takes is one disgruntled worker who is not afraid to tweet or blog or write an op-ed or write a, you know, an op-ed even for the local trade publication, and then somebody searches on your name and up comes that with a title, Joe Blow is a racist. And so, you know, we have to have a, I don't know if we call it a healthy respect or an unhealthy respect for people's potential to destroy you. Your reputation is much more vulnerable. It's more like on a strid than on monofilament fishing line. You have to be careful. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah. I think people love to tell a negative story and love to repeat it. And as they repeat it, they almost can't help embroidering on it, so the story gets even worse as they repeat it. So if you find yourself this happening to you, I think you've got to address the issue as quickly as possible, as forthrightly as possible, and as I say, the single most effective thing I've found is to ask for evidence to back up assertions. Assertions are easy to make, but the evidence is often hard to find.
Remember, the truth is all of us have made flaws. There isn't one of us, you, me, or anybody listening to this show, who doesn't have something that they wish would not be trumpeted all over the media. And so the key is to, you know, we're not going to be saints. So the key is to avoid the amplifier, the person who is likely to magnify, to amplify that. Because we're not going to be saints. I think I want to give my listeners a chance to ask you a question or two. If you either is fair. I mean, I've done my best to stay as focused on the career front as I can. But if you have a question for my guest, who is Charles Learson, he is the author of what I consider the definitive fair-minded biography of Ty Cobb, subtitle A Terrible Beauty. I invite you to call with either a question about Ty Cobb, because there's nobody who knows more about him, or something about reputation management that you'd like to either hear Charles or me discuss about managing your reputation. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, I'd like to give you one softball question. Every single guest who has ever appeared on my show has said, oh, I wish I would have said that. So here you go. If there's one more thing you wish you would have said about Ty Cobb or reputation management that you'd like our listeners to hear that might be surprising or interesting, what would it be?
Well, I think the most surprising quote, if you know Ty Cobb's reputation, as I did going into this book, and I should say when I started researching this book, I was in the other camp. I assumed he was a racist, and I assumed he was a dirty player, because I've been hearing those stories all my life, and I had no reason to think otherwise. Mm-hmm. It's when I started to do real old-fashioned research, the way you would do if you were writing a book about Abraham Lincoln or J. Edgar Hoover, or if you would just writing a history book. Baseball books have a lower standard of research traditionally than regular history books. I was trying to apply the regular history standards, and what I found was I worked 4 years on the book, but I often say when I make a speech, 10 minutes into my research, I began to find inconvenient truths that contradicted the myths that I've been hearing all my life. And I guess the single most surprising quote, it comes from Ty Cobb in 1953 when he was asked about the racial integration of the Texas League, the minor league, which was finally getting around to doing that 5 years, 6 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in the major leagues. And Ty Cobb said, "The Negro should be accepted wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. The Negro has the right to play professional sports, and who's to say he has not?" Now, that's a pretty strong quote coming from a guy who's often depicted as the worst racist of all time.
Especially in 1953.
So, yeah, and at that time, if you know baseball history, you know that a lot of guys were just weren't saying anything. They were keeping quiet on the matter. They didn't believe in racial integration, or they were saying, oh, it's too soon, or it's not fast, or it's too fast, or I don't believe in it. Or you know, he said, accept it wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. And that's coming from a guy who's often depicted, as I say, as the worst racist of all time. So, you know, if not only ask for evidence, but if you ever have any counter evidence to what people are saying about you that's negative, that can be very useful too. And I think that quote is a very powerful bit of counter evidence about Ty Cobb.
It is. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Charles Learson, the author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. What is your question or comment for him?
Hello.
Hello.
Am I on?
You are.
Okay. My question is this. Can the author do something about what he's presenting, because he's presenting fascinating stuff? Did he go at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown? Can the author in some way ask that his material be in next to Ty Cobb's inscription? Because it probably doesn't say anything about this in his inscription in Cooperstown. Can I get some information about that?
Your thoughts, Charles?
Well, his Ty Cobb's inscription is sort of neutral there. It doesn't say, it doesn't mention anything about the bad news. But a couple of points on that. My book is sold at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and I was fortunate enough and lucky enough to make a speech up there and I was accompanied by Ty Cobb's granddaughter Cindy Cobb, who I didn't meet until after my book came out, actually. But since it came out, we've become friends, and we addressed the crowd together up there, and I gave a little talk. So it has been accepted, and the Hall of Fame has been open-minded about this. And it's hard. Fewer people read a book than watch a movie. And there's that horrible movie with Tommy Lee Jones still out there that gives all the bad, wrong impressions, and it's actually based on the work of this guy Al Stumpf that I constantly mention. And so many more people see a movie than read a book. But I'm hoping that over time my book will change minds. I know it has changed some already.
Wow, you know, bad news does metastasize. But wouldn't that be great? Another movie about Ty Cobb, the truth. You know, that would be the fantasy. You know, most writers are, you put 4 years of work in here. No matter how well your book sells, you ain't going to get rich. But if somehow it got made into a major motion picture, suddenly Charles Learson would be able to move into nicer digs or whatever. Anyway, thanks for the call. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Charles Learson, the author of Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. What is your question or comment for him?
Am I on then?
You are.
Okay, good. I was wondering where your guest puts Ty Cobb relative to the other great players. And a follow-up question would be, if he's as good as I believe he is, why ESPN hasn't done something? And that would certainly get the word out there.
Charles?
Well, ESPN... they're on their website. They wrote very favorably about my book. They've covered it. Their writers have shown that they're open to it. So it's not like there's been no publicity or my book has been ignored. It's won several awards and it's gotten around. Yeah. It's gotten talked about. So it's like I say, I think we are making some progress. As for where Cobb fits, well, he still has the highest batting average of all time. He still holds the record for stealing home. It's very hard to compare since we have no film footage of Cobb, almost none. There's just a few seconds it adds up to of film footage of Cobb. So, and he played so long ago, so it's hard to compare. Baseball players are different eras, but I think he was the most exciting player of all time because of the way somebody said that Babe Ruth hitting a home run is not as exciting as Ty Cobb getting a walk that was a sports writer of the time. And I know what he means because it was very exciting when Ruth hit a home run, but when Cobb got on first, then the fun really just began. I mean, here's a guy who once stole second, third, and home on three consecutive pitches. And he also once got an inside-the-park home run on just a little tap back to the pitcher's mound that he turned into an inside-the-park home run. He didn't even slide when he came home, and he scored safely. So he could electrify a stadium with his base running, and I kind of think I rank him as, as the most exciting player of all time, certainly.
Anyway, thank you for the call. You've got my curiosity has got the best of me. How the hell does somebody hit a tapper back to the box and he ends up getting a? I mean, I can see where there'd be errors where the pitcher threw it into the first base and threw it wild. But how the hell did he make that an actual inside the park home run?
Well, there was a guy on third base when he tapped back the ball, and that guy ran off third base and wound up getting caught in a rundown.
Uh-huh.
So no one was paying attention to Cobb, and he got all the way around. It's just as that guy was getting tagged out between third and home, Cobb was stepping on third and came by them and surprised everyone so much that no one could put the ball on him, and he just ran by the catcher, whoever had the ball at that point, and he scored. But, Ty Cobb was always he always said a mental hazard to the opposition. He always wanted to upset people. And as I say in the book, that if there was a statistic for causing bad throws, errant throws, because that he would hold that too. He'd hold that record too, because he upset the field of players whenever he came out, and people made mistakes, and he profited from them.
Well, you certainly did hit the ball out of the park, at least from as far as I'm concerned, with your book, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. Charles Learson, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
My pleasure, Marty.
Take care. Bye. All right, and now, as usual, we turn in the second part of the show to you. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I do something called workovers. In 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I try to help you solve your problem, help you take a baby step, maybe even a giant step forward in your work life. Whether you're 16 or 76, a clerk or a CEO, for-profit or nonprofit, I usually can help. If after 27 and a half years doing this show I've been doing, I can't do it. If I can't do it now, I'll never do it. But you're going to get all that for the right price. Zero, zippo, nada. So, phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. A couple of weeks ago, I did a show in which my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I did a debate on the issue of is college and graduate school still worth it? We like doing those sweet sides in the middle debates because they enable us to really do our best job of presenting both sides so that the, quote, winner of the debate is not which person wins, but which side is got greater merit. I got a letter in response to that from somebody who said, you didn't give enough attention to the PhD. You focused so much on the undergraduate. And so he wrote, one of my psychologist friends with a PhD at UCSF said she has more respect for the PsyD, that is the practical version of a PhD, because they have more clinical experience. And apropos to today's show, this person writes, I guess he didn't ask for confidentiality. He says KC, I guess is his moniker. Apropos to today's show, the link below has a segment with Freeman Dyson saying he knew two colleagues whose PhD destroyed them. One committed suicide. And what he wrote was, he says, Freeman Dyson says, the interviewer said, you never got a PhD, Freeman. And he says, no, I was so lucky. I slipped through the cracks. Freeman Dyson was one of the most legendary scientists of all time. I won't go into the details. He said, quote, I hate the PhD. I think it destroys people's lives. I had three tragedies that I witnessed with people who came to work with me and came to grief. One committed suicide. Two ended up in mental institutions. I do blame the PhD system. It was a disaster for many. It's completely inappropriate for what most people need. It was designed for German academics in the 19th century, and for that it was fine. But for any other kind of life, it's totally wrong. It takes far too long. By the way, the mean time to a PhD is 7 years. 7 years of the prime years of your life, usually your mid to your most of your 20s and part of your 30s, perhaps. I'm continuing the quote from Freeman Dyson. It forces you to pretend to be a researcher when most people don't want to be researchers. It's become a union card. I think it's highly destructive. Fortunately, in those days, it wasn't as rigid as it has become later, end quote from Freeman Dyson. So I do, I am well aware, more than you probably know, that a PhD is not only required, but even that barely gives you a hunting license for a researcher job. I was privileged to be asked by the Society for Neuroscience to do these workovers, these five-minute makeovers. They actually were 15, at the last national conference, the international conference of that society. And person after person with PhDs and postdocs, that is, a two-year enslavement at very little pay underneath somebody else's wing, how many of them were still struggling? Be careful. Now that we're reaching May 1st, which is normally the deadline where you have to plunk down your commitment money, whether it be for a bachelor's, a master's, or a PhD, please do not be seduced by the university's marketing materials, their website, their brochure, let alone their tour guide, that implies that your prospects of being employed after you put down all that money in all those years will indeed be strong. The world has changed. We have a great oversupply of degree holders. We have what I call degree proliferation. Yes, it is often worth it, and it's often prerequisite. But please, at least view things with nuance, with moderation. You have to consciously and carefully weigh the pros and cons of getting that additional degree versus the opportunity cost, what you could otherwise do with your time and money. Still to this day, many scientists and business leaders have decided, you know what, I'm enough of a self-starter to do my learning on my own with apprenticeships, with mentorships, etc., and some short courses, and not that whole elephant of 7 years of courses that you may or may not need or want. As I've said before on the show, as part of my PhD, I had to take 6 5-unit graduate-level statistics courses, not because it was necessary for what anything that most of us students would have to do, but because there was a very powerful professor who wanted to teach his very esoteric, very advanced statistics courses. Be careful. Caveat emptor. You are indeed a buyer. Caveat emptor. Anyway, phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I'd be happy to do a workover on you. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi. Is it me?
It is.
My question is how to get out in front of a poor reference from a former employer. Should the new employer, through the process of interviewing, decide to check?
Best practice is the following, no guarantees. First of all is to look inward and ask yourself, is cosmic justice served by that bad rep? Were you really, you know, do you deserve to be punished, if you will, for bad performance? And to the extent, you know, nobody's perfect, but to the extent to which maybe it unfairly saddles you, the right thing to do is to meet with that employee, the previous employer, and say something like, yes, I erred, or maybe no, I didn't. You stipulate to the problem, so you're not just being contentious, and say, but I'm terrified. I've learned a lot from it, and I'm terrified that a bad reference will consign me to unemployment or gross underemployment. I'm wondering if we could discuss what you could say that would be honest without necessarily being totally destroying of my future prospects. Could you see doing that?
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. In my case, it's a very large employer, and I have no idea who that person would be, and they've never met me. That would be something I'd research.
I would do two things. I would, first of all, very large companies normally, because they're so afraid of getting sued, have a policy against giving any reference other than, yes, this person was employed from this date to this date, the person left voluntarily, was not fired, and that's it. But what most decent employers for a decent job will not just accept that. They will find your own. They will ask you voluntarily. You have to. You're not required to, but say, who was your previous boss? And they will reach out to that previous boss. And sometimes that previous boss will hew to the party line, to the corporate policy. But usually they will at least in tone convey that they hated you or liked you. So if that former boss wants to hurt you, they can say, oh yes, this person was employed here, I am precluded from saying any more. Well, that's a kiss of death. Or that person, oh yeah, this person was employed here, yeah, from this day to this day, unfortunately the company policy doesn't allow me to say anything. So it's incumbent upon you to talk to that person to at minimum get the tone changed if possible. And sometimes many employers, notwithstanding the corporate policy or the or nonprofit policy, will go on at great length to say good things and perhaps not so good things about you. So it's worth talking both to HR as well as to your former boss, to see if some kind of a reasonable accommodation could be made.
I guess, and one last one, is it just too risky to bring it up during the interview process?
Excellent question. And that's a gray area. I was very definitive about what I said before, and here I am on the fence. I am the older I get, the longer I've been doing this, the more I am a believer in radical honesty, both because it's cosmically just, but also there is such a distrust between employer and employee. It has been said that the job interview are two people lying to each other. And so if you stipulate up front, you say, as I said to the previous guest, get the bad news out early. So if you say, I want to say something up front, that I did not get along well with my previous boss, and in fact, I made a serious error. So I would imagine that if you contact this boss, he's going to say X. Well, I thought I would save you the trouble. Here is exactly what happened. Of course, there are other good things about me, but if that's a deal killer, we should cut off the interview right now. Now, that takes a lot of guts, but sometimes that is the very best thing you could do, both from a pragmatic and a cosmic justice perspective. Could you see in this particular case, if you're currently interviewing for a job, could you see saying that, or would you think would the wise man within you say it's better not to do that?
Well, I'd rather, I don't know, but certainly for the purposes of this discussion, I'd rather have tried than not try and know why I didn't get called back for a second interview because of that, of actually being proactive about it rather than, just wondering what happened.
Exactly, and it's psychologically liberating you from the ball and chain of your past screw-up. If you say, let's take a bet. I loved using this example. I've used it before on the radio, but I love it. Let's say you had committed armed robbery and you were sent to jail to San Quentin for 4 or 5 years. And you compounded the felony. Often they say the cover-up is worse than the crime itself. And so on your resume, you listed having gone to school for 4 years at San Francisco State. And it's true, except that you did it while you were a prisoner at San Francisco State, and San Francisco State offered these courses in the prison. So you've both lied about it. But imagine now that you were the employer, and I was the job interviewee, and I was that person who committed armed robbery, and I lied on my resume, and I said that I was I was in school for the last 4 years, and I say, I'm grateful that you interviewed me, but I feel I need to be disclosed something very important up front. While I will be happy to share my strengths, which I did share in my cover letter, and I think you see in my resume, there are two real dirty, dark secrets that I need to reveal to you, and I would talk about the truth about the felony and about the resume, and I'm saying, of course, because I've so erred, I'm going to need to start at the bottom. But because of that, I will be the most loyal and eager employee to make a difference. Would you immediately discount me for even that horrible disclosure that I had committed armed robbery and that I lied about it on the resume? Would you consider me?
Well, in theory, I've already considered you in bringing you in for an interview.
Even after that, would you say, well, thank you very much, I appreciate the honesty, but I really don't think we can hire somebody who lied on his resume and who committed a felony? Or would you continue to talk with me?
Well, I would, whether in this thought experiment, yes, but as I've gotten older, I realize, I'm far from being a pristine person, and there is no such thing as someone who doesn't make mistakes, as somebody who just hasn't done very much or has gotten extremely lucky. But in this particular kind of radical thought experiment, the person has already clearly paid for the crime. Having been let go from a job, in theory, you could say, was paying for it with period of unemployment, but in this case, having gone to jail, it's done.
No, it's not. The truth is it's not, because the past is a predictor in part, not perfect, of the future. Because somebody with the temper or the ethics to commit armed robbery is at greater risk of doing some other kind of dishonesty in the workplace. So it is it is not just done. You can't write it off. But the reality is, and you implied that, that you would, yes, you would interview me. Here is the truth. 8 out of 10 employers would not. They might continue the interview to be polite, but in the end, they would not hire the person. But 1 or 2 might give that person a chance. And a phrase I love to use is, I really need somebody to give me a second chance. Perhaps someone gave you a second chance, and that can personalize and create an emotional bond with the person so that, yes, it probably will take you longer to find a job if you are as radically honest as we've tried in this thought experiment. But in the end, you will not only be hired by the right employer, somebody who's probably got a kinder heart and has more circumspection, but you will be freed of the shackle of that ball and chain of your back, and you really legitimately can claim a fresh start rather than be hiding this dirty, dark secret. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anyway, I thank you very much for the call. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello. I've just got a question about being a coder and the ageism in the industry.
It's huge. Coding is perceived as both a young person's game, and, you know, because of the H-1B visas, where there are many, many people from countries that have a tradition of valuing coding and engineering, etc., you're competing with in a very tough market. But the good news is, when you're applying for a job, if you can send samples of your code and you're still, I don't care if you're 86 years old, if you can show that you can program in difficult languages, not just Python, but Ruby or assembly language or R or whatever, that can trump the one, to use the baseball metaphor, because I just interviewed a biographer of Ty Cobb, it may be one or two strikes against you to be older, but you can still hit a Grand Slam home run if you can show them great code using the languages that are current. Does that make sense?
I'd like to make a comment on it, though, that I'd like to support it in a way, and I think one of the main reasons for it is...
Support what? You say you want to support it. What is it?
Age discrimination when it comes to hiring people for startups.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
And it also refers to the interview you did of the guy about the baseball player.
Okay.
It's just a feeling that I'm actually Australian, but I'm a joint citizen. I've lived here 30 years.
Okay.
And one thing about the United States I notice is a huge difference between Australia and the United States regarding the winner-take-all culture. And that was raised in your point about how you play baseball as a nation and how you have to watch your back from the people that you hire.
Yes.
Who are trying to knock you down.
Yes.
Australia doesn't have a winner-take-all political system, and the whole culture isn't run that way. So my idea is that the young people with their startups are approaching their organizations much more different to your age group and my age group. They're looking more to a joint sharing of responsibilities where the strengths of individuals are immediately identified because people are working so closely together. And a shortcoming is just regarded as a way of making sure that you do what you're best at rather than a way to destroy a person. And I think that underlies the culture, I mean, the whole idea of young people only hiring other young people. Millennials will only hire other millennials because they're the only ones that understand it. Their parents still have your attitude of winner take all.
Okay, first of all, I want to thank you for. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
All right. I don't have an attitude. You know, I'm a little sensitive to the notion that I have an attitude toward winner take all because Ty Cobb was a fierce competitor. I also am a little uncomfortable with the generalization about a whole generation being either more collaborative or more, you know, or more selfish. Indeed, it was the boomer generation, or is the boomer generation, that began the whole primacy of collaboration, teamwork, community, society, making a difference. And so, you know, I could easily see a 70-year-old, you know, or a 50-year-old, six, whatever, having a collaborative mindset, and some 20-something being just that somebody who wants to make money and they want to go, you know, I've seen many of these startups, and all they could see is
exit strategy. I don't care really about how good the product is. I want to get out, you know, make an exit strategy, go public or go private equity. You know, I'm really concerned about generational generalizations like that. So I want to thank you very much for the call. We only have a few minutes left, so I want to try something a little unusual. I really enjoy tweeting because it enforces me to distill into a very time-effective amount of reading time for my readers my best ideas, and I use it as an archive of my best ideas. So in the couple minutes I have, I'm simply going to read you some of my more recent tweets that are related to career, of course. Job seekers, to gain leverage in negotiation, compress your job search into 2 weeks to up the chances of getting multiple timely offers. Next one, job seekers, they need to connect intellectually to demonstrate expertise, match communication style, and bond emotionally with the employer. Next one. The most valid self-help advice: stay in the moment on your current baby step and then the next baby step. The next tweet: the reward for work well done is the opportunity to do more. I didn't say this. This was Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine. Next tweet: while on today's hike, I overheard this. I don't want to take a job. That'll screw up my unemployment checks. Next tweet. Savvy businesses have a smart employee pretend to be a competitor. That helps predict what it will do to compete with you. Thinking or meeting while walking boosts your brain power. Next tweet. A problem may have both a rational and an irrational component. It may help to solve those separately. Society, having replaced the no and here's why rejection letter with the no response, is rude, dispirits the would-be recipient, and deprives society of feedback. Next tweet, talking too much is a career killer. Keep utterances to less than 45 seconds, and in dialogue, speak a bit less than half the time. A desire to, quote, give back needn't imply helping the neediest. It could mean helping those with the most potential to benefit, as every wartime medic knows. Next tweet. Those who charge a fortune are often not worth it. Many of the best and most ethical charge moderately and are quiet, not big self-promoters. In refining an idea, it helps to describe it to people because the idea iterates each time. Next tweet, most people learn too little at conferences to justify going. The payoff is mainly in relationships you build if you're good at networking. Many people don't burn out from long work weeks. They burn out from doing work they're bad at or from working with the wrong people. Successful people compartmentalize. While working, they refuse to let personal worries intrude. If your self-esteem is low, perhaps focus on finding work you can succeed at. Real self-esteem comes from accomplishment. Next tweet, I wonder how true it is that people feel empty if they have a soulless but remunerative occupation such as bond trader. A resume is usually too filled with chemistry-inhibiting cliches. Instead, write and tell the resume that reveals your true story and self. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to debate issues for working couples. Plus, career change after 50, what's realistic and not. Plus, I'll read a couple of short stories I've written about career change after 50. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.